Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get all the latest football headlines and bite-sized opinion in the brand new Whistleblowers Daily Podcast. Join Mark Smith, Martin Grutten and a conveyor belt of guests as they dissect all the biggest stories in one small, perfectly formed package. Take 5 to 10 minutes out of your day to stay up to date with everything that matters in football. Whether it's a big result from the night before, a new excuse from Jurgen Klopp, a shocker of a VAR decision, or a new chapter in the ongoing Man United soap opera, we will cover it. All the latest news, every weekday lunchtime, on the Whistleblowers Daily Podcast. Look for the Whistleblowers wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Stop Hammer Time. My name is Phil Whelans, and with me this week, a great friend of the podcast, a writer, broadcaster, and owner and proprietor of a podcast of his own about West Ham.
Yes.
U-Irons is your podcast. It's Sam Delaney.
Hello, Phil. Hello everyone.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Very good. Two wins. Since we last did one of these podcasts, we've won twice. One against Anderlecht away in Belgium and one at the weekend against Fulham. So all very satisfactory. Were you at Fulham, Sam?
I was.
Yeah.
Jimmy Greaves, God rest his soul, was right when he said it's a funny old game.
It is a funny old game.
Because the way in which things have turned around, I'll be honest, I try to be a positive West Ham fan most of the time. I'm, as I think of you as, definitely as well. We're a dying breed, right?
Yes.
But even I, after the defeat to Everton, was getting a bit like, I almost had the dread phrase on the tip of my tongue, he may have taken us as far as he can.
Oh.
Which is obviously the sort of thing Spurs fans say about managers, like, after one defeat. And I don't want to be that guy. And I didn't
say it after a goal's gone in.
Yeah, they do.
Quite often they say it when they lose the coin toss.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah.
And, apparently my brother has told me there is a large contingency of people saying that about Conte, or at least they were after the defeat to Arsenal.
Conte was like the perfect manager for Spurs in that when he first took over last season, they might have like not done very well in two games. And he himself said, I might not be the manager to take this club for. You're the perfect Spurs. You are made to be a Spurs manager.
I think I've taken them as far as I can.
Yeah, yeah. After about two games.
Yeah.
Well, it might not be. I might not be very good. That might be the problem.
I like Conte because he is proper mad. And we need, you want the Premier League's at its best when it is crammed full of insane managers.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, really like that for me, more than the football sometimes, is the real appeal.
Yeah.
Whenever I start to watch Match Today, which I never do anymore. But when I did, the appeal of it for me was always just getting to see the managers be insane after
the
match.
Yes.
But there was a golden age when Martin O'Neill was still going.
Yep.
And Steve Bruce. And then Mourinho was in his prime of madness.
Yeah.
You know, And it was just great, wasn't it? So many nutters. Yeah. Ferguson, nutter. Wenger, yep. Nutter. Like, but all different sort of flavours of madness.
Yes. Yeah, we've talked a little bit about the new emerging, the young bucks of mad manager.
Yeah.
Because we got a very mad Nigel Pearson at Leicester.
Oh, yeah.
He sort of started fights.
You could argue that he's almost the classic of the genre.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's never been a... Do you remember when he went, "Are you an ostrich?"
Yeah.
Remember
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
"Are you an ostrich?"
Yeah.
He might be the best.
But then, of course, sort of recent ex-players, because Tim Sherwood had quite a big strain of madness in him when he
he started wearing that gilet, which was the first sign, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That something might be up.
Scott
the first
Parker,
sign at which you do the old, you know, the Gary Lineker, have a word with him.
Yeah, yeah.
When he came out in a gilet, that was a have a word with him moment, wasn't it?
Scotty Parker is a bit mad.
Is he? I haven't noticed this. Has he gone mad? I mean, manager does it to all of them.
Yeah. Well, when they went down Fulham, he was a bit mad towards the end of that season. He was a bit mad then.
A relegation freak out that I quite enjoyed. I'm ashamed to say, you know, as you know, I'm a big advocate for mental health causes. But at the same time, here I am, like, reveling in the mental collapse of high-profile sports managers.
Yes.
Right? So yeah, I'll hold my hands up and say there's some hypocrisy here. But, you know, it's all good knockabout fun. And and really, it's, you know, you can see it's very tough for anyone. But when Sam Allardyce sort of always prided himself on keeping his cool in a crisis. So even when he was stitched up by the press out of that England job, which I have to say was an absolute travesty of our time, really. Not that I necessarily think he would be the best England manager ever, but I just think, poor old Sam Allardyce. Do you know what I mean? Like, he was he had his dream job, right? He'd finally got it, and he hadn't had a chance to really make his mark or even begin to yet. And then they do a video of him drinking wine out of a vase, and suddenly he's not allowed to manage England anymore.
No, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
You know? And I feel really bad for him, but he always prided himself on never losing his shit and sort of, you know, Big Sam, I'm tougher and bigger and better than everyone else. And one of his favourite things was he'd never been relegated, but then he did get relegated at West Brom as a result of defeat to West Ham, a team who, let's be honest, had gone out of his way to make snide remarks about, both when he was our manager and then certainly after he was our manager.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had a meltdown live on TV in the post-match interview.
Yeah.
And started going, you're all happy now, aren't you? Oh, you're loving this. And you'll all say this about me now. Oh, this is your dream come true. Well, forget it. I'll never come back. Not ever.
Yeah, yeah. It was great. It was wonderful. Wonderful meltdown. Talking of meltdowns, he's not mad, but Marco Silva was jumping around on the touchline quite a lot in that Fulham game. He was very unhappy and he got booked, didn't he?
But I love to see a manager booked, which is part and parcel of this whole discussion. When a manager loses cool so much that he gets booked, I am like clapping like someone scored a goal. Even Moyes, if it's my own manager. When Moyes got booked against... One of my proudest moments as a West Ham fan, perversely, was our ignominious defeat to Eintracht Frankfurt in the Europa League. Because the way in which West Ham responded to it was absolutely superb, right?
First of all,
our manager volleyed a ball at the head of a German ball boy, right?
Yes.
Then our captain loudly accused the referee of having taken a bung.
Ref, corrupt.
Yeah. Then our striker Antonio, I think, he said to a German fan who was gloating in his face, "How much money do you earn?" Which I thought was great. Yep. And then on top of that, Kufau said in a post-match interview straight after the game, "Were you worried by the pitch invaders?" And he said, "It's no problem for me if they invade the pitch. If they do anything, it's going to be a big problem for them."
Yeah, brilliant.
And then, just as the icing on the cake, when David Moyes was asked about booting a football at a child, he just said, "Well, it's set up just right. It would have been rude not to."
Yeah, yeah.
And I just think, if you're going to get knocked out of Europe, get knocked out. Like, that's the West Ham way right there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone, all of us collectively lost our fucking shit.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
We're not going to go out nicely. Right. We're not going to go down smiling. We're going to go out ugly. And I thought David Moyes really led from the front there. And yeah, he totally had a meltdown. He went mental. He got sent off. And I applauded him for it. That's the sort of passion I like to see.
Me too. I loved it. I really liked the... I was at the 5-1 defeat by Leeds United when we were, when Leeds were last in the top flight of football. About 1999, something like that. Because Wrighty was in the team, wasn't he? And Wrighty smashed the referee's dressing room up after the game, which I thought was excellent. We had three players sent off. I think we had three players sent off. And we were talking about that thing that a game's said to be void if you get down to like seven players or something like that.
So we should have gone for that.
Yeah, so we should have, you know, shooting the moon in cards, isn't it? Should have done that and had more players sent off. But that was very good. In fact, the last sending off, which might have been Sinclair, that did seem to be out of just sheer fury at the fact that we were having players sent off. I'll get sent off as well because I'm so cross.
Talking of sendings off, I mean, basically, let's just let it be known, in case it's not clear already, we love when our team lose badly. Bad spirit. I hate to see teams lose and then... I hate to see my own team lose and then shake hands and go for a drink afterwards.
Fuck that.
Want to see us... I want to see every defeat reacted to. For me, the Eintracht Frankfurt defeat was the template.
Yeah.
And that, if I was Moyes, I would have said, that's what I want to see next season. Anytime we lose, heaven forbid, that's the kind of attitude I want to see.
When England had that game against Argentina in the 1966 World Cup, and the Arges were, you know, really filthy, and Sir Ralph Ramsey ran on the pitch and stopped them swapping shirts and was snatching England shirts back off Argentina.
Sir Ralph Ramsey was a proper little Englander, wasn't he, though? Bloody foreign scum. He called them animals. Bloody animals.
Yeah.
It's the Latin temperament, you see. They can't control themselves. They've got fire in their blood.
That's right.
They're
certainly not taking one of our shirts on the plane back to Argentina with them. They'll be stuffed at the airport. It'll be taken away from them.
Argentina.
Flight will be commandeered and brought back to Gatwick Airport and the shirts returned.
We should all behave more like Argentinians. Like, one of them got sent off and he sort of insolently took the flag off of the corner stick and just, like, dropped it. That's a funny, spurry sort of provocative thing to do. Especially and you're trying to provoke a man like Alf Ramsey, who would be easily provoked by that kind of thing.
He sort of wouldn't go, would he, either, the Argentinian player? No. He just stayed in the centre, saying, I'm not going to go. No, I'm not going. Not going to go. No,
I'm not going anywhere. Yeah. You make me, little referee man.
You make me leave the pitch.
Yeah.
I stage my right to be here on the pitch.
Look at you, you're a little man. You're like a little fucking monkey man in your stupid black outfit. Look at you. Put your silly card away.
My father has killed a man. His father killed a man. I will kill a man.
When they kill the man, they bring the blood home for the child to drink. I am that child. I drink the blood of two dead men. I have taste for it.
So it was... it was a funny game, funny old game, as Greavesy would say, because I thought on Saturday, Sunday, every time we scored a goal, it seemed to embolden Fulham and make us retreat slightly into our shell. I think these games are, you know, going to be a bit less and less like that, but they are still quite nervy, aren't they? The wins are nervy because we really fucking need them.
We need them, but there's three wins in a week.
Yeah.
And each game, there was an incremental improvement.
Yeah, definitely.
And we are still nowhere near our best. And by our best, I mean probably the way we were playing about a year ago. It's been a long time since we've been anywhere near our best.
Yeah, definitely.
But this team has the potential to be even better than the team from a year ago when we, you know, beat Liverpool at our place.
Yeah.
That kind of sequence of games where it really looked like we were going to make a real fist of going for the top four at one point. And then a year before that, or 6 months before that, when Lingard was there, there was a period where we were really kind of in our pomp. This team now is showing signs that it could be significantly better than either of those teams. But we have to wait and see. At the moment, look, we've certainly got better players. I think that much is undeniable. In Kerra, Scamacca and Paqueta, at the very least, you've got three players who are way superior to what was there before. Like, not just one notch up, several notches up from what we've had. And once there are signs now that they're starting to all click. And so that's really exciting. But, certainly against Fulham, there was still, it's a game that certainly could have gone either way. I mean, Fulham, after they went 1-0 up, had at least two other very good chances.
They did,
And so it could have gone either way. It was not
a Dan James, that ex-Manchester United player, hit the crossbar, didn't he? With a very good shot that, was quite close after that first goal.
And I think, what's his name? The bloke who scored.
Pereira.
He had a free kick not long after that from a similar angle.
Yes, yes.
Out there on their left, our right, and it was sort of punched away. By Fabianski. So at that point, Pereira was tearing us apart.
Yeah,
easily my favourite part of the game, more than any of the goals, was Pereira's giving away that penalty.
Wonderful. I mean, wonderful.
What a wonderful performance by him. First, he came out on the pitch and for 10 minutes he looked sort of world class. He was absolutely ripping us a new one.
He was, right?
Got a great goal, and he was taking the piss. And I'm looking at him thinking, why did United let him go? He's better than any of United's players. And why didn't we sign him? I was thinking to myself, he's better than Paqueta. We should have got him. He was cheaper, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so he does that for 10 minutes. Then he goes a bit quiet. And then he just does the most strange, mad sending off I've seen in many years.
It was good. It was
penalty.
Yeah, yeah. But it was very pleasing because the referee sort of stuck to his guns in a way that like sort of rugby referees are good. They go, I'm warning you again. And then, the inevitable to everyone in the stadium happens. But for some reason, nobody else, including Marco Silva or anyone sort of from Southwest London, could believe it because he said, I'm going to take out a red card in a minute. I'm going to award a penalty in a minute if you keep doing that. So guy did it again, did it? And finally, he did what he said he was going to do, which is really good. It's very good when they kind of stick to their guns.
And I like it that Pereira stuck to his guns as well.
Yeah.
Because Pereira wrestled Dawson and the ref said, don't do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he said, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not doing anything wrong.
Yeah.
And so then the game restarted. He did it a second time. And he said, why have you done that again? He goes, because I do not recognise the rule you are trying to impose upon me.
Like an Argentinian footballer in 1966.
Yeah. I played by my own rules.
Yeah. What we've got here is a disagreement about the philosophy of your rule structure and your whole approach to life in the 21st century.
Who are you who are you to say what is wrong and what is right?
Yeah.
You're not God.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so they go, well, okay, I appreciate that, but this is a complex kind of discussion, philosophical discussion we're getting into. All I can tell you is I'm in charge of this game. So if you do it a third time, I will give a penalty. And he said, well, prepare to give a penalty in that case.
Yes.
Get your finger ready to point at that spot because I'm about to do it again. Watch. And then sure enough, he did it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I've done it again. And if anything, the third time it was worse.
Yes.
Just to make it more explicit.
Yeah.
It reminds me, Cantona got sent off in France once and he goes, he's fucking in a bad mood. He's fouled, he's fouling, kicking players, lashing out, responding badly. And the ref says to him, gives him a yellow and says, Eric, calm down. Why do you do this? You're a great player. And you don't need to react like this. You need to calm down. We don't want the game to go this way. And Cantona looked the ref in the eye and said, prepare the red. And then, literally, the game restarted. And moments later, he flew into another tackle.
Yeah.
And the ref brandished the red. And Cantona, according to the ref, looked at him as if the victory was his. Like, see, I told you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, the sort of fundamental, it's like the football match becomes a kind of metaphor for two different philosophies.
Yeah.
The philosophy of Fulham Football Club and the philosophy of West Ham Football Club. The yeah. winning philosophy wins.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
well,
that was
we just can't play by your rules. It's not yes. the way it would be lovely if the world did work the Fulham way, but it doesn't. It works our way.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Grow up is what my message is to Marco Silva, Pereira, and everyone involved with Fulham yeah. Football Club. Grow
the
up.
The world won't fall into line based no. on your worldview.
Exactly.
When that Fulham player went over to try and put Bowen off, he was saying, it's not a penalty, you know. This isn't a penalty. None of this is happening. You're yeah. not about to kick that ball into the net. You are, but that's not what's going to happen. The ball won't be in the net because you won't have kicked it in the net.
How do you know you're not just in someone else's dream?
Like
that's what he said to him.
Yeah.
And Bowen went, well, I don't know all about that. I'm more of a steak and bake spud man myself.
Yeah. It's like Plato's The Cave. Plato's The Cave is a sort of symbolic thing about kind of illusion versus reality, isn't it?
Mm.
And that was like that. There'll be philosophy books will be talking about the West Ham penalty, the Sunday, October the 9th West Ham penalty as yeah. a kind of, as a sort of Schrodinger's cat. Is it a penalty or is it a concept? Yeah, yeah.
But yeah. don't you think like, I don't think, to be fair to Jared Bowen, I don't think he's the sort of lad who you could put off with challenging philosophical propositions.
No.
Yeah, he's too much of a professional.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah.
You're not going to get under his skin that way. There are players you could.
Yeah.
But not Jared. Not Jared. He's not going to listen. He's going to block that kind of noise out.
Yeah, that's right. When we had that cup game against Manchester City where we won on penalties and we stuck five penalties away. We stuck the first four away. And I think the last one went to Saeed Benrahma, who, with his slightly poetic eyes stuff, I thought he might miss this. I thought he's going to miss this. He will go into a kind of existential funk going, who am I to take this penalty kick? Why me? Who should take this penalty kick? What have I done to earn this place in this position in history?
Who am I? What am I?
Am I an abstract concept or am I Saeed Benrahma? And actually he stuck it away really well.
He
did, Bowen on Sunday.
Yeah.
He said...
Bowen's penalty was actually a really good, confident penalty. And just thank fuck, because, you know, it was just awful, wasn't it? The whole it was just the whole penalty situation with Declan Rice. I mean, I talked about this on New Irons this week that, like, you know, obviously you've got to be careful sounding like you're criticizing Declan Rice at all. I would never do that, Phil.
Not
I want everyone to understand that before I say what I say.
Right.
But I think that watching Declan Rice now that there's a player like Paqueta next to him in midfield makes me sometimes wish that. Yeah, basically, Declan Rice is so good and has been so, like, comfortably our best player for so long that he sometimes takes too much upon himself, right? So he's fantastic at what he does, but there are times in the game where one thing he'll often do is when it's out on the left and Cresswell's got it or Fornals has got it, you know neither of them fancy taking a fullback on. They won't.
No.
So they will look up and Rice will invariably come across and make himself available and they will play that short pass back to him.
Yeah.
And then Rice looks up and the attack is still, we're in possession, we're comfortable, we're in the final third, right? We've got, we have to be patient and pass the ball around and wait for them to make a mistake. That's how Premier League football works when you're playing at home against a defensive team. Rice, far too often from that position, looks up and thinks, I'm going to ping a crossing.
Yeah.
And to, you know, and this, I suppose it's a criticism, but it's not really because I don't think it's an essential part of his game. To be honest, he's just not that good at doing that. How many assists does Rice get a season? Not many.
Yeah.
He doesn't get many goals. He doesn't get many assists. I don't think that matters. I think Claude Makélélé, who's arguably one of the best, if not the best, player in that position modern times, right? Yeah. He wasn't worrying about his assists and goals, right?
No.
The problem is that Everyone talks about Declan Rice, you know, is he world class? Is he worth 150 million quid? And this debate goes on and on, and how good's he going to be? And is he going to be in this? And, you know, that must get to him. And he starts to think, he starts to play like he's Steven Gerrard, right? So Steven Gerrard was a bit of a one-off in that he had that physicality that Rice has got. He could get all over the pitch and defend. He actually started as a central defensive midfielder like Rice.
Yeah.
But then he started to make those rampaging runs, which Rice does do very well. But not many of them result in assists.
No, no. They often run a bit out of steam.
They're great to watch. Yeah. The only time I can remember, there's three occasions I can remember them working. Once was against Zagreb, where he scored a solo goal. Yes. Once was against Kidderminster Harriers, where he just had to take it upon himself to basically run past them.
Try and win the game on his own, yeah. Because we were
so
rubbish.
And once was against Palace, where he did it, and then he played a square ball to Lanzini, which actually wasn't a very good pass, but Lanzini then juggled the ball and scored a great goal. And if you look at those, two of those goals were against, I would say, second-rate opposition, third-rate in Kidderminster. So the only one that came against the proper team was against Palace. And even that, it was like Lanzini had to take that pass and do something truly magical to make it look like a good pass.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that when we lacked a little bit of creativity at times in the absence of Lingard, and we were kind of relying on a lot of the time Lanzini in that like creative role. And yeah, Lanzini's fine and all that, but he's not really up to being a top class number 10 anymore.
No.
Declan Rice started doing that, but against Fulham, I just thought, Deck, stop trying to play Hollywood balls. You don't need to be that guy. You don't need to be Steven Gerrard. You can just be Declan Rice. You're brilliant. Yeah, you are the best midfielder in the league. But wouldn't it be like that midfield, if everyone stuck to their roles, now that Suchek's improving a little bit, it's pretty much the most balanced midfield in the Premier League. You know, if Rice sat there, right, and just played an anchor role in front of that defence, you let Paqueta do the creative stuff and you let Suchek just run around and get in people's spaces, just be annoying, right?
Yeah.
Then that's a superb midfield.
Yes.
I think Rice needs to have more discipline, but I wonder whether Rice is so, he's such a big figure at the club, because what we've got is a world-class player.
Yeah.
At a club that is not an elite club. And therefore, even with a pretty tough guy manager like Moyes, I wonder how much Rice can be contained or controlled. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, he and Suchek, had a very sort of unique sort of partnership, didn't they? Which, funnily enough, was slightly mirrored in Calvin Phillips and Declan Rice for England in that they were both slightly jacks of all trades, And I think that, in a sense, that was... that can be to the detriment of players' kind of international careers, because once you get to international level, they want someone, a sort of bespoke player, to fit every single department. I mean, that's sort of why Mark Noble's England chances slowly evaporated over the years, because I think any England manager's going, yeah, but what is he? Is he a defender? What is he, a defensive? Yeah. Is he a tackle? Yeah. What is he? And I think, Rice, in a way, was very fortunate with England that Calvin Phillips was there, because I think, there was an awareness that Declan Rice wasn't necessarily like Gareth Barry, a sort of absolutely dedicated screen the back four, never go past the halfway line, type defensive midfielder. There was a little bit more to his game, but Phillips was like that. They managed to job share very well, I thought. And it was the same with Suchek. But now Paqueta is more talented and you do want to get him the ball. And, if they were playing a two rather than a three, you could see it as a kind of Paqueta's the Brooking and Rice is the Bonds,
What I actually think as well, which is sort of slightly separate point, is I think eventually Paqueta, I think, is playing increasingly well in the position he's being played in. But I think that Paqueta could play next to Rice.
Yeah.
I think he did play that way for Lyon.
Yeah.
He wasn't a number 10. I think part of it is Moyes thinking, he's Brazilian and a bit fancy. We'll stick him in number 10 because he can't do much damage there. But you look at him and actually, out of possession, he's a serious midfielder.
He's
big, he's strong, he won't be bullied, and he's extremely mobile and athletic, right?
Yeah.
So he can get around no problem. And I think that if you watch him, how he was at Lyon, a lot of the time, now you look at him during the game, and what he does is he's got his back to goal, and he shows for the ball. So when we've got it deep, he's running around trying to find pockets of space, and he's holding his hands out like, pull it into my feet.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of the other players are a bit cautious about doing that, because if you play a ball like that into the middle, there's a chance you could lose possession, and then suddenly you're on the defensive. So players are nervous, obviously, about doing that. And as a result, I think he's not as involved in the game as he potentially could be. If he was playing instead of Suchet next to Rice, he would be getting the ball deep. It would require Rice to be much more disciplined about always staying back. But I'm happy with one defensive midfielder when that defensive midfielder is Declan Rice, because he's the best there is, right?
Yeah.
And then Paqueta, who can, he's not going to stand with his hands on his hips. He's not going to be like Paolo Di Canio when you're out of possession, right? He will run and he will tackle and he will get the ball back for you. But when you've got the ball, I think he might do a bit more damage with the game in front of him, running head up and play and pinging balls here and there, because his passing is absolutely superb. And
I agree,
playing with your back to goal, I don't know, it's like, I thought he was really good. He imposed himself on the game a lot more against Fulham than I'd seen him do.
He's
so
definitely
far.
Going into it. Yeah, yeah.
But I still think that I'd love to see him in that other position. But I think the chances of Moyes doing that without there having an injury crisis necessitating it, pretty slim.
Yeah, quite possibly. We'll carry on with this after this message. Welcome back. Dan Silver, who was on this podcast last week, he said the same thing. He thought that he should be in a more kind of deep-lying position like he is for Lyon. But I think he was, like you said, kind of hunting for the ball more and making himself available and finding pockets of space at the weekend. And he seemed to be developing quite a relationship with Scamacca, which we saw in the Anderlecht game as well.
Yeah.
The goal was a result of their interplay. And that's sort of very encouraging, isn't it? I think we've been crying out for sort of someone to give slightly better service to our player furthest up the pitch, whether that's Antonio or anyone who's played, you know, Allaire slightly was suffocated of service a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Again, we played the Anderlecht. We'll return to the Fulham game, but the Anderlecht game was, one thing we do seem to be returning to a little bit is, even though it's perhaps not the most, you know, the kind of exciting aspect of a David Moyes West Ham team, but we're sort of we're able to win without playing all that well.
Yeah.
Sort of win ugly, and that was a big part of those couple of seasons, the sixth and seventh place finishes with Moyes. There were plenty of games we didn't really deserve to. I think we beat Leeds 1-0 twice in the same season and probably didn't really deserve either of those wins, but we got them. They didn't score against us. We did. We scored one goal, and one goal was enough to win those fixtures. And there were quite a few games. That Fulham game, when their player missed the penalty by taking possibly the worst penalty we've ever seen. Undeservedly won that game. But that was a sort of feature of the Moyes West Ham team. And that's often the case with the teams that go on to win the division. It's like Manchester City and Liverpool in those years they won had plenty of games where they just, you know, somehow snuck past the other team without playing all that well. It's just getting into that kind of winning habit. And
well, I think that the thing is, there are two things. One is we got into the winning habit, and you're right, we could have, those games, Fulham could have gone either way, but and Europe has helped us get into the winning habit.
Yeah.
But the key thing is the quality. Is the extra added quality
is starting to tell.
So, you know, against Wolves, shit game, neither team were particularly good. But we had Scamacca and Bowen up front.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
And Scamacca scored an absolutely outrageous goal that most people just wouldn't have the capability of doing. Hate to say it, but Antonio would not have scored a goal like that.
And
Jarrod Bowen, you know, great persistence, scored a great Jarrod Bowen goal. He's got that direct sort of way of playing. He's always looking for the goal. He's very persistent. And that was the difference. It was just very simple. It's just better players. And then against Anderlecht, we were able to bring Paqueta and Scamacca off the bench.
Off the bench.
And they combined to score a goal. Same against Fulham. It's just the quality. It's the quality that we've got. And, you know, it was a shame that we've already lost five games, because five games is a lot, right? Yeah. It really sets you back. So even if we go on a great run now, you know, unless we avoid losing again, to have already lost five, very, very tough. So it's a shame. And I don't know what the reasons for that for. And like I said at the beginning, I was starting to get pretty worried. And I thought there was something up with the squad. And now, obviously, I've changed my mind on that. But like, I was worried. Anyway, that period, we seem to be coming out of it. And I think that this team now, with the quality, it makes you think, Jesus, we're all moaning about no signings last season.
Yeah.
And some people going, it doesn't matter, the team are great anyway, you don't need signings. Well, we did, because we've added these players, and we would have been in the Champions League last season, or maybe the season before, or maybe both, with just one or two of these players. If we had Scamacca, let alone Paqueta, playing in either of those teams from last two seasons, I think we would have had a very strong chance of finishing fourth.
Yeah, absolutely. Though, I mean, in a sense, I mean, obviously it was a wretched start, notwithstanding some of the bad luck we had. You know, things didn't go great at Chelsea, which we drew that game and then had our draw taken away from us, and just, hitting the woodwork and clearly being the better team against Nottingham Forest, but somehow contriving to lose it. But it was always going to be, a question of what another season was going to be like after a sixth place finish and a seventh place finish and qualifying for a European competition twice after being relegation threatened, the previous season. So, we had to sort of have ourselves mentally prepared for a season where we might finish mid-table and not qualify for Europe. You know, I mean, when there was a lot of sort of naysaying directed at Moyes, I was sort of reminded that his Everton were the team that, given, the similar nature of the finances of clubs, they were the team we wanted to be, finishing, on the fringes of Europe, or sometimes even in Europe in those 10 seasons.
Yeah.
Plus also having rocky times in which sure there are a lot of Everton fans going, he's taken the club as far as he can, Moyes out, Moyes out.
No, I think there was Everton fans who I spoke to you on Twitter around that time a couple of weeks ago when people were starting to get very nervy, and not all of them are completely positive about him, but they did all make the observation that he often, followed a good season with a bad one.
Yeah.
But sometimes, it's rare for managers to have longevity. When they do, like he did at Everton, you're going to have ups and downs because you always have to have a rebuild season. You have
absolutely
a team,
yeah,
and that's what this effectively is. It's a massive rebuild. It's a rebuild that we may never see again, a rebuild of this size. I mean, I certainly can't remember that many players coming into a squad, especially potential first team players. Pretty much everyone we signed is either immediate first team or will eventually, they're earmarked to not be backup, but to eventually be first team.
They'll get game time, Even Emerson's getting game time, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, he David Moyes is obviously rabidly loyal to Aaron Cresswell.
Yeah, unbelievably.
But Cresswell is really good. He's a really good footballer. His legs have gone a bit and he doesn't
I've got to say, I prefer Emerson. I would be picking Emerson. I can see why Moyes isn't, because I suppose you could say Emerson's like a better, less insane version of Masuaku, because his instincts are very attacking.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he is better than that. He won the Euros and actually was brilliant throughout the Euros with Italy.
Yeah.
He's not a man. He's not like a complete liability, which, let's be honest, Arthur was, right?
Yes.
And he is like, whenever he's started or even come off the bench, for me, he's created something practically every time.
Yeah. Yes, he has. Yeah.
And Cresswell used to be a great creator and he just isn't anymore. And so, he's very reliable in defence, I guess, although he's very exposed if he comes up, if he gets targeted by an opposition manager of a pacey winger. And then you really need four nows to be an extra left back, basically.
Yeah, you do.
And so that's the problem with his legs. But going forward, he used to be, in his younger days, great on the overlap. He'll never overlap anymore. And then even when he stopped doing that, he could deliver great crosses from a deeper position. He might come up with a couple of assists like that a season still, but it's not quite enough. And I think Emerson is like, every time he's come on, he shows like really great instincts. But again, Moyes is a cautious bloke. He'll think, oh, I don't like that. He gets forward a bit too much.
And I don't think I don't think Moyes has kind of discounted him in the way he did, you know, Alex Kral or possibly to a degree Vlasic, because he's giving him minutes and playing him in the European games all the time. I think he does kind of like Emerson. He hasn't sort of just discounted him in the way he did those other players. So, you know, it's good that he played. Yeah. Antonio's goal was sort of, I thought, was 100% Antonio. It was like characteristic of an Antonio. It's going to go on his showreel because it had, he sort of picks it up and holds it for a while, runs along in it. He also has some defenders bounce off him. And then there's a hilarious mix-up between two defenders. It's the almost the definitive. It's like proper fan fiction of an Antonio goal.
I will take that goal and I will lay over the Yakety Sacks.
Yeah.
Or if not, what's the circus one? Very much that.
Yeah.
If you Google the phrase, what is Michael Antonio, Michael Antonio, that clip comes up, doesn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. It was a real pleasure to see that. It's sort of I think, you know, his first goal for us when he got his chance in the team because Victor Moses got a knock and he sort of came on and had very much the same role as Victor Moses, which was a little bit of a maverick. He was a kind of self-starter and made things for himself, really, by barreling up the right side of the pitch. And I think his first goal was from a kind of lying down position and sort of went his shoulder or
neck. Scored trundled goal that you trundle the ball over the line.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. And
yeah, me too.
Wow. After the problems we've had in the forward positions over the last few years, to have your international striker score with such technical brilliance, followed by your English striker, who we all love, come off the bench and score just the perfect Antonio goal. It was both goals were so indicative of the two men, weren't they? They symbolised what they both stand for. And it's really exciting because I think, I hope, and I have confidence that we're going to see that a lot. Scamacca start.
Yeah.
Someone was telling me actually at the game that I wondered why. I thought Scamacca was our best player on Sunday. I thought
he was very good.
Not just the goal.
Yeah.
I think he's... there's so much to his game. He's got strong Teddy Sheringham vibes, the way that he drops deep and just, he doesn't just hold the ball up. He holds it off, he plays it off intelligently so he can create goals for others, very much like Teddy Sheringham, because he also, like Sheringham, he can also finish both with his head and his feet like Sheringham could. Also, Dean Ashton vibes, strong Dean Ashton vibes as well. I always thought Ashton was a similar player to Sheringham as well. So he's got all of that, pacier than both of those. So I think that's great. But I think, you know, I could really... apparently, he gets taken off a lot in Italy at around the 70th minute. So it's not just to do with his maybe his fitness being low. That is apparently just... he burns himself out in 70 minutes. It's very common for him to be substituted at that time. But then I think Antonio coming on as defenders start to get tired. What an absolute nightmare when you're knackered already. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it was great to see him in a foot race with a little bit of kind of bargy as well as a bit of barging as well as, you know, sprinting. Because we haven't, since he's been declared a number nine, we haven't seen him sort of sprint any distance for quite a long time now, quite a few years now. And I sort of wonder whether he's still capable of that, because he would have these periods when he was injured where he bulked up enormously in the gym. And when he came back, was actually oddly immobile for a guy that was supposed to be our kind of blistering paced sort of wide man. But then, you know, there'd be periods where he had a more sustained period in the team, seemed to kind of slim down quite a lot and was back to that. You know, when someone that strong is also in a speed trial with a defender, you know, it's a nightmare. There's two ways you're not going to get the ball off him. One is too quick and the other is too strong. And it's always sort of felt that the possibility was sort of there for him to, you know, sort of play. And I think they did do that, play with Scamacca. But also if he is a sort of straight swap, you know, you want to get him in positions where he runs at them, because that's where stuff happens when he does that. You know, he's not an absolutely dead-eyed marksman. It's not like sort of, you know, David Cross going, if you put the ball in the six-yard box, I will just break, what's the expression I'm looking for? Bust a gut to...
break my balls.
Break my face.
I'm willing to break my own colon to get that ball in the back of the net.
That's
how serious I am about performing for this football team.
I will burst my own eyeball to get that ball. Boss, can you stop David Cross talking to us before games? Because it's putting everyone off.
Lads, let me tell you one thing, lads. I'm willing to rip my own anus completely open.
Get that ball,
To get that ball, and if that's what it takes, it won't take that, David. Well, it might. And I'm saying that if it does, then you can count on me to be that man who will rip his own anus open. With his bare hands, if necessary. Don't worry about it, David. I don't think it'll come to that.
David, could you... just some of the younger players, could you just not just say hello and then just keep walking, because you're sort of freaking some of the younger players out. Do you remember when Wenger came to Arsenal? It was a not dissimilar time to Tony Adams starting to go to AA and start to kind of work on his personality and stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember Ian Wright on, you know, like a sort of football preview program saying, Arsene comes in, gives us a team talk, and it's all very technical, and I don't really understand what he's talking about, but I just sort of nod my head. But now what happens is he gives that team talk, and then Tony comes and gives us a team talk, he's the captain, and I cannot understand a fucking word, because it's all kind of like new age self-awareness
stuff.
He was just basically going, I don't understand both of our pre-match talks. And I just thought that was so funny.
Sort of linked to his teammate Ray Parler sitting down in front of Eileen Drury and asking for a short back and sides. And then subsequently never being picked for England by Glenn Hoddle ever again.
God, I've forgotten about Eileen Drury.
Try to never forget. My attitude is never forget. I might just post a picture of her once in a while on Twitter with the hashtag never forget.
Maybe we should call that... maybe we should call this podcast that.
Just picture call of Eileen it, Drury. Just call it In Memory of Eileen Drury.
Drury Madly Deeply. Drury Madly.
I mean, what is Eileen Drury up to now? I would love to know, right? I would love to know what she was up to. And people are, she's now just become this sort of footnote in the history of the England team. But for me, someone should make a whole Netflix documentary series about Eileen Drury's involvement with England, because it really is that sensational. Like, if you weren't there, you wouldn't believe it.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, tell kids of today who haven't heard the story. You know that the England manager, as recently as 1998, employed a mystic to
work on the coaching staff
with our World Cup team.
Yeah.
She went to the World Cup. Well, when you say mystic, you're exaggerating for comic. No, I'm not.
Yeah.
She was a faith healer.
She, like decided which end to play towards based on the tea leaves.
Yeah. She literally just held players' heads. And we're talking players of the stature of Les Ferdinand.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
These are Paul Merson. Serious professional players with great careers. She'd set them down in the chair, place her hands on their head, and just try to transmit positive vibes into them.
And you do not hold Les Ferdinand's head. You do not hold that man's head.
No, not unless he is fucking giving you a written invitation.
Exactly. As central defenders the world over have discovered, you do not hold that man's head.
Don't even look at his head.
He was good for us, wasn't he? He was right at the end of his career, wasn't he? And I think he got injured. I can't remember. It's sort of, is it when we were down 2004, 2005?
Yeah, it was. He joined in our relegation season as a final Hail Mary. We went out and we signed.
That's right.
We signed Boya, Les Ferdinand, and Rufus Brevet.
We did,
and that was our sort of Hail Mary, but it didn't quite work because we had so many players out injured. And I think we'd had Defoe playing up front on his own for most of the season because he couldn't handle playing up front on his own. So Les Ferdinand came, but I got to know him. I worked on a World Cup show with him in 2006, and he is one of the nicest blokes, certainly one of the nicest footballers I've ever worked with.
He seems such a great bloke,
very intelligent, right? But I obviously worked with him for a whole summer, and I plugged him a lot about what had happened with that relegation season, which, you know, it was a good three, four years after it. And he told me a few things, but he said, you got to understand about Paolo. He would just say, I'm not playing today when we were going to an away game.
Yeah.
And he went, and that's really weird. And he goes, it's especially weird when you're the captain of a team that's in a relegation battle.
Yeah.
And he would just be temperamental and say, no, I'm not getting involved. Do you know what I mean? I don't fancy it. Fuck off. Do you know what I mean?
The captaincy was taken away from Steve Lomas and given to him, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I remember. And I imagine Lomas was probably a really good captain, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
A bit of fire and thunder. Yeah, yeah. No, it's great, Sir Les. It's brilliant. Yes, so it's...
Hands off Les's head. That's an alternative title.
Yeah, yeah.
Keep your filthy hands off of Les's head, Eileen.
Yeah, yeah. That's quite long.
A bit long for a title. Yeah. Maybe a subtitle. I don't know. Well, maybe I'll just put it on a T-shirt.
Yeah, I think so. If in doubt, stick it on a shirt.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So we've got Anderlecht again on Thursday, and we've got Southampton on Sunday. I'm going to both of those.
Oh.
Very excited.
Lucky you, going down to Southampton. I went to that last season. It's a nice ground, actually, St Mary's, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I've been to that quite a few times.
Good away day.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got to fancy us, haven't you? I hate to say that because it tempts fate, but let's be honest, Southampton are struggling. Yeah. We're on the up. I just hope that Moyes makes sure that the team are 100% up for it and aren't thinking, we're on a run now.
Yeah, you know, God, yeah.
Because, of course, Southampton beat us twice last year, once in the cup, once in the league.
Yes,
and we drew 0-0 at their place. So we didn't get much out of them. Three games, we got one draw.
No, no.
And so, you know, they're not, no team in the Premier League. But that manager, I don't mind that manager. I've always thought he seems like quite an interesting bloke. Another great member of the Mad Managers Club that we admire so much. I think he's all right. He probably will get the sack this season. It might even be after the game against us if we win. But you can't underestimate. He kind of outthought Moyes on three occasions last season.
Yes, he did. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because we've sort of got a fairly good recent history against Southampton. I seem to see us, you know, beating them a fair few times. But we have, Ralph Hasenhüttl's Southampton's been a bit of a kind of hurdle for us.
Yeah, he's like Ralph Hasenhüttl's been a hurdle. Fucking hell, mate.
Yeah,
I can tell you've been classically trained.
Oh, yes.
With that kind of tongue twister.
Vocal warm-up.
That's what you do, don't you, before you go out on stage? Yeah. You say that exact phrase.
Yeah, yeah.
In the mirror.
Hasenhüttl's a hurdle. Yeah. Hasenhüttl's
a hurdle. Yeah. That is actually genuinely impressive. I think that they're a little bit like a kind of a mini Brighton to us. That's how I saw them last season. It's like they had our number.
Yeah.
So on form and certainly on play, we've definitely got better players. We can say that now for sure about many teams. We've got the better players. We should have the better team. We're in better form. But yeah, I mean, you know, that manager, just like what's his name, Graham Potter, kind of seems to have Moyes' number. So we'll have to wait and see. But I feel as if, is it prediction time or not?
I think so, yeah.
I still say 2-0 West Ham.
2-0. I'm going to go, and I've been correct in this this prediction before. I think one season I said it was going to be 3-1 and it was. So I'm going to say that again. I predicted 4-1 for the Fulham game. So I was like, you know, when there were 5 minutes of extra time, I was like, come on.
Fancied it. Yeah. And we could have easily got a fourth at that stage because they were distraught.
Yes. Finally.
And what about Anderlecht?
Well, it was a fantastic position, wasn't it? I mean, that is one thing about Moyes, is like we've done very well away from home, and especially in these European tournaments. We give them a real sort of, you know, even if the Frankfurt game, we sort of gave a good account of ourselves in that game, I thought. And, you know, to come back to the Thunderdome with a 1-0 advantage is really good. And I sort of think 2-1, I think we could win that 2-1.
I don't think they looked all right, Anderlecht. They're certainly the best team we've come up against.
I think so, too.
It was a close game. Without those substitutions, we wouldn't have won it, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
So I think it will be tough. I think another 1-0 win for us.
Right, 1-0, sounds about right. Well, that's probably it for this week's Stop Hammer Time. My name has been Phil Whelans, and still is. And with me has been Sam Delaney.
Thanks for having me, lads.
Come on, you Irons.
If you want to advertise on or sponsor this show, check us out at playbackmedia.co.uk.
Sports Social Podcast Network.